I guess it's still morning, so good morning. We are, like I said, as I say on every one of these, I've given up trying to sound original in the beginning. We start at the beginning with easy question to get warmed up, and that's where and when were you born? I guess I should say this is. I'm talking to Thomas Albert, just to have that on the record. But where and when were you born?
I was born in Tokyo, Japan, 1954, January.
Child number one, two, three?
Child number two.
Out of
two. Okay, my father, on the other hand, has been married three times, and so I have two half-brothers and a stepsister from his other marriages.
Was your mom his first?
Second wife. Child number two of second. Wife number two.
Okay. It's also, in the beginning, a good time to kind of get names, some names of, like, your brother. I'm assuming your sibling is a brother.
Yeah, my brother is named Chad. Okay. He lives in Boulder. My father is Harry Francis. My mother was Florence Teplin.
Okay. And you're somebody else. Your name is... different yet again. Is there an explanation for that, or is it a?
Oh, I meant.
Oh, you're
father.
Giving middle names.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Francis.
Of course. Okay. So you, his last name is Albert.
Albert.
Okay.
Yeah, my father. My mother's maiden name is Teplin.
Okay. A good way to sometimes start this out, at least for some people, is to just ask them really, what's in their first memories, and we'll turn it off again. As I was saying, one way maybe to start this flowing is to ask you, you know, what maybe some of your first memories are. A lot of people have vivid first memories or recollections of.
Oh, I don't recall what my first memory is.
Or even some early ones. I mean, just your first kind of consciousness of. Being a person, if you will, or an event that was striking, is usually what first memories or even a regular kind of daily routine, for instance, being walked in the park or something,
mm-hmm,
like, you know,
mm-hmm.
Like that.
Well, there's certainly lots of scenes of Japan and Tokyo that are striking. When I was small, we lived in a Japanese farmhouse in a part of Tokyo that's now built up and has high rises on it. So the house is gone, but it was a traditional house with a big thatched roof and tatami mats in the house. So it was not a Western style house. It had quite a nice garden that was a formal garden. That,
mm-hmm.
You know, I remember sitting on the wooden sort of hallway that looked out on the garden, and the sun coming in and moss that had grown on the stones.
I don't know.
You know, it's an image, I think, that's very non-Western in that sense. And growing up in a foreign country, I think there are a lot of those types of images that I have, that I remember.
And what you, I'm not sure I'm exactly following what you're saying. Is that, you got that? You're saying in more of a sense of you are being in a foreign place? I mean, you don't have much of a, or you're talking about that with hindsight now. In other words, you're looking back and seeing that these are not American.
Well, I didn't think of it as a foreign place at the time, certainly.
Okay, right.
I've lived in the U.S. for almost 30 years, so I definitely considered this home, but there are aspects of American culture that seem foreign rather than Japanese culture seeming foreign in those ways.
Mm-hmm. You said it was a farmhouse, and the area's now built up. Was it where you, I can't even imagine, though, that even a farmhouse in Japan is really that isolated from neighboring homes or?
Well, we had neighbors, but the house was on a fairly big piece of land, and there were fields around it, even though it was a suburb of Tokyo. And my brother and I used to chase each other through the fields that seemed to be sometimes over our heads and play hide and seek and things like that with friends, you know, in areas where you could hide in
hide and seek
in what growth or
these were crops. Fields cultivated.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Gross that high that they grow. I have no idea about
that. I was a little kid, sure. So they didn't have to grow that high. Whatever it was, I don't remember.
Right.
Let's see. I went to nursery school in Tokyo. I remember bits and pieces of that. I went to an American kindergarten or an international kindergarten at a school called the American School in Japan. And I guess I have good memories of that. I enjoyed it. I liked to draw, for example. But I didn't like to take my naps. And because of that, my teachers recommended to my parents that I not go on to first grade. And
you could learn to take naps, or because this was a behavior issue?
Presumably it was a behavior issue. You know, I didn't follow directions. Yeah. So we had this horrendous meeting in the sort of dining room of the house we were living in. By this time, this was the second house, I remember. Okay. And it was a Western-style house near Tokyo Tower. And I remember we had this sort of formal dining room with a big table that seemed awfully thick when I was...
it was never used.
5 years old. No, that's where we had dinner.
Oh, okay.
We used it every day. But it was on the side of the house, and the sun was coming in, and in from the yard. It was a big sort of Western-style yard at this point where I used to play a lot, and we had a dog pen out there for the dogs. My father had English pointers, or my parents had English pointers. My father was, very serious and saying, son, the teachers have recommended that you not go on to first grade, and what do you have to say for yourself? What are we supposed to do about this? I don't actually remember any of my responses, but just the scene was pretty intimidating. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up going to a kindergarten that was a Japanese kindergarten. So.
Because the place wouldn't take you for a second year, or your parents just felt maybe you'd do better in a new situation?
I don't really know what the reason was. You know, maybe they didn't feel that there was any point in me going through that again. I have no idea. I guess that's what I assumed.
Yeah, sure.
But instead I went to a Japanese kindergarten, which is actually much more substantive in the sense that you learn to start writing Japanese characters. And so you practice over and over again in these books how to write each of the phonetic characters.
Mm-hmm.
That school was also in my neighborhood, so it was easier to get to. But that was a difficult experience in the sense that I was the only foreigner in the school. And I felt very shy about talking. So even though I spoke Japanese mm-hmm. fluently, I didn't really say much. And the other kids used to sort of tease me, thinking that I was stupid or that I couldn't talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember this was happening one day over our workbooks, and I sort of swore under my breath at my attacker, and one of the little girls sitting next to me sort of beamed her, well, she also said something, I can't remember what she said, but she expressed her active support that I was standing up to this guy.
And you were swearing in Japanese, I take it, right?
Yeah, I was swearing in Japanese, or it must have been six or something like that, yeah. And then from there I went back to the American school in Japan for first grade. And apparently I'd
overcome
I'd
your
become acceptable
problems.
Exactly.
Lord. I guess then that even in both places that you lived as a young child there, it wasn't, oh, this is a community of foreigners set off from the Japanese population, or...
That's right. They were both in, you know, Japanese neighborhoods. They were very upscale Japanese neighborhoods, but nonetheless not in some kind of foreign compound or anything like that.
And, you know, again, my knowledge of Japanese culture and history, especially post-war, is very dim and minuscule at best, but I guess I get the sense that, you know, after the war, Americans were rather occupiers, and maybe not that, I mean, we're now talking, what, 58, 59, maybe?
Mm-hmm. 59, so 60.
We're talking 16 years, and I know things rapidly, you know, changed, where the Americans weren't in that position of overseeing a military presence, I realize that, but there wasn't any... You weren't aware of that situation of, Americans had recently been the conquerors of this, of these people, or I guess I still think of certain areas of Germany where to this day, because of the American military presence, there's a hostility or friction between the German community and the American.
I guess as a child, I was pretty much shielded from that. You know, maybe that was something that Japanese people expressed toward my parents, I have no idea. But there was a substantial military presence still in Japan. So we used to go to a beach area south of Tokyo in the summers and on weekends. We rented a house, the family rented a house at the beach. And driving there, there was the road went by a U.S. naval base at Yokosuka. And this was a huge, huge, huge installation with, you know, aircraft carriers and, you know, massive ships and huge numbers of people. And in some ways, I guess I heard stories from my parents about the sort of ugly American syndrome that some of the naval personnel fell into. Another type of military experience is when I was at the beach, there were the remainders of the fortifications that the Japanese had built to defend the island from a sea invasion. And so my friends and I used to play in these caves that had held artillery pieces. And in fact, my parents, my father said that the first time he went down there, the guns were still in place, just cut up so that they couldn't be used. But certainly when I was a kid, we never found any of the guns, but we did, you know, occasionally find ampules and some weird things that had been left and not completely cleaned out of these sort of tunnels that ran under the hills.
So you're talking about maybe even like food or
we didn't find
medications or
it seemed like it was some kind of medications that we found, but these tunnels were extensive and you know, really creepy for a little kid, but that was part of, you know, it's like being on a roller coaster or something. It's part of the scary thing to go back in there with a flashlight and are there going to be animals or insects or whatever.
Of course, you're probably not allowed to do it. And
ghosts. And of course we weren't allowed to do it, exactly.
Which was the other part of the fun, right?
Had you much sense then? I mean, were you traveling back to the States? Did you have relatives? Had you much sense of
this other, you know, your native, if you will, or your...
No, that I got a sense of that only from television. Wonderful World of Disney.
Okay. So was there a full gamut of American television in Japan at that time, or just the something like Disney? I mean, were you watching Leave It to Beaver also, or...?
I can't remember if I first saw Beaver here or there. You know, it's the type of show that might well have been dubbed in Japanese and presented on Japanese TV. But no, I didn't come back to the States until my parents were divorced in 1964.
So you were 10? Well,
I guess 12. That's not coming back to the States.
Well, but it's actually an interesting use of a phrase then to...
Yeah.
So
I was 10. Yeah.
10, okay, not 12. Yeah. Maybe it also implies that, you know, that your parents, and maybe you knew other Americans or other foreigners, you know, that this wasn't your, you know, this wasn't, even if you were born there and you didn't know anything else, that Japan wasn't your, quote, home or your, there was always a sense that you would come back to the States for school, for whatever, I mean...
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, the Japanese culture is not inclusive, and...
at least that's what we hear today.
And I think many of my friends, well, certainly most of my friends were foreigners, and most of my parents' friends were foreigners. And so, regardless of the fact that we lived in a dispersed way, mm-hmm. the culture itself was such that... you felt like a guest.
How many Japanese friends did you have, let's say? I mean, were they 20%? I mean, none?
I don't know, it's hard to remember. Certainly when I was in a Japanese school, I had more Japanese friends. And
this little girl, perhaps?
Yeah.
An ally, or...
Yeah. But probably most of my friends were foreigners.
Yeah. You sort of described yourself as shy, at least in the situation in the Japanese school, where there was a lot of hard work in it, and you did feel, you know, obviously marked as different. without, you know, you had no choice in that sense. How would you describe yourself, let's say, upon returning to an American or an English-speaking school, and?
The school experience was pretty, I don't know, I can't really think of one word to describe it. The problem was that the curricula of the school here and the school there were completely different. Telephone in the other room.
Oh, okay. It sounds like my alarm clock that I turn my travel alarm clock, and I'm like, is that going off in my
No.
mind? Okay, excuse me.
No. So, for example, things I would have learned about grammar in the next year in the school in Japan, I was already expected to know by the time I got to the school here. So the school here was in Bel Air in L.A., a public school called Bellagio Road Elementary. A very rich neighborhood, and my mother specifically found an apartment in that area so that I could go to that school. She was really concerned with finding a really good public school that I could get into.
She thought you might be a little behind and you needed the extra, or that you were a bright kid and you needed the stimulation.
Well, I don't know whether she thought of me as a bright kid or not, but she just wanted a good school. Mm-hmm. So what happened was I got to the States, and you know, just the journey was bizarre. I came by myself, but that's another story. So I took a sort of a placement exam at the school to get into the fourth grade, and you know, basically I couldn't do anything that was expected of me. I could do the mathematical part, I guess, but the language was was
really difficult.
Was huh? really difficult, not because I didn't speak English, but because I didn't have the sort of training that elementary school students here would have gotten.
I recall my own experience at that age, whether there was a lot of grammar, I guess.
Well, just identifying, for example, what a noun is, it's really odd, but I remember... you take a sentence and I was asked to write down what the noun was. Well, I didn't know what a noun was. I could speak English, I could write, but...
And if you'd already kind of learned grammar in Japanese, I'm assuming it's such a radically different concept. And does anyone even call it grammar? I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe because I learned Japanese from living there in addition to the Japanese classes that we had in school. My Japanese language was very instinctive. And so I don't remember, really picking apart the Japanese language until I went back to Japan when I was 12 and went to a language school. And there it was, the training or the classes were much more formal, but the language, the Japanese language that I knew was, learned from television and learned from being on the street and learned from talking to people in a sort of non-structured way. So trying to apply that structure to English when I came here, I just didn't have any basis for that.
I mean, the whole idea of what the language is and how a language functions is different, right, for Asian. I mean, that's my understanding. I don't know much about it, but I get the impression that it's psychologically even it's a different...
Certainly, yeah. The language is more complex. There are more multiple meanings. There are more subtleties that involve who you are and who you're talking to.
And that, like, nouns and verbs aren't so much anything structurally important as perhaps, images or...
Well, there you're getting very sophisticated, but, for a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old, it was still important to try to convey that you had some relationship to the listener. But those are the sorts of things that, to me, I felt were more intuitive. And I don't remember. I know that, for example, in second grade, the Japanese course I took in school had, formal drills and things like that, but I don't remember any of them. I remember certainly being comfortable speaking, and I have been told that when I lived there, if someone was talking with me on the phone, they couldn't tell that I wasn't Japanese.
Were most of your, let's say, American or English or European, contemporaries, other kids, as equally?
Certainly my friends that had been born in Japan spoke the language fluently, but there were many children who came from foreign countries and were just learning the language. I should say the language in my home was English, and that was my sort of
daily language. Did your parents
learn
Japanese, or did they speak Japanese? Or?
They both did, but not meticulously.
It's a tough one, I think, for speaking romance languages in English.
Well, it's a tough language, that's true, but I have a suspicion that the level of language skills that my parents sought was something that reflected their relationship to the country rather than what an inability to learn the language. Certainly my father had been there since the U.S. occupation. He went over in 1945 and landed on the beach south of Hiroshima near a Navy base called Hiro, and it was a, he was in the first wave, or the first group of people who went onto up the beach on the landing crafts, and you know, they were fully expecting to be shot when they went there. Worked as a county governor. He was a lieutenant in the army, and his what his assignment was to administer the occupation in a county in southern Japan, and so he
Like a municipality, or is it good? You know, is the word transferable to our notion of a county?
Well, it was called a prefecture, but. Yeah, it's more like a county, an area that has many different cities in it. Yeah, or it was a rural area, an area that had a well-known artist colony.
What was it?
Called Kurashiki. And he was in charge of finding out what the people needed to live and rebuild and obtaining those things from the U.S. occupation government, you know. So I guess that's a pretty romantic view of what he was doing there. But you know, he has told stories about meeting with Japanese leaders, and finding out from them what they would need to get, say, industry started again in this area. And there's one particular town where there was a hill that that split the town, and there was a tunnel through the hill. And the Japanese had put many of the machine tools from all the factories in the area in the tunnel to protect them from bombing. And so my father tells a story of seeing this, being shown this by the town leaders, and asking them, well, what do you need to get these machines out of the tunnel and back into the factories? And they said, well, nobody told us to do it. And so, to make a long story short, he wrote out an official order on the hood of the Jeep and signed it and gave it to them, and that's what they did. Got things going again. So, in some sense, you know, there were logistical things about food and real concrete things that he was responsible for. And in another sense, it was simply relationships. You know, he was a public figure in that sense. He talks about, or told me about, meetings he would go to where the first thing he would do is take off his 45 and the holster that it was in and hang it at the door to show that he wasn't there to intimidate the people in a military way.
This was the reason he was there when, I mean, you say 45, and of course you were born in, I keep wanting to say 52, but I think it's 54.
54, yeah. So, yeah, certainly that was the reason he was there. He he had been an instructor in the infantry through much of World War II, so he hadn't been in combat, essentially. Mm-hmm. And toward the end of the war, he was given the opportunity of going to paratroop school or going to the Pacific, and he chose the Pacific. He didn't want to jump out of airplanes. And so he was involved. He was on his way to the Philippines when the atom bomb was dropped at Nagasaki, and he was involved in sort of the way I understand it, sort of mopping up operations in the Philippines after the Japanese had surrendered. there or had been beaten there. And then he was slated to be part of the invasion force when the Japanese surrendered.
And he never left. I mean, he never went back to this. I mean, whether he went back for a month or two, but he...
Right, so his military orders kept him in Japan until 1948, when he was court-martialed. He was accused of disloyalty for involvement in a black civil rights group in Tennessee in the 30s. So he was involved in TVA and had run out of money at the University of Maryland, and so got a job with the TVA in I think it was Knoxville. I'm not exactly sure.
And what, run out of money at Maryland? He was in
He was in college. No, oh, he was a college student. Yeah, University of Maryland, majoring in chemistry. And didn't have enough money because of the Depression.
Sure.
So got a job and had been involved in civil rights causes when he was in Tennessee, and that was considered a communist front activity.
Mm-hmm.
By the late 40s. And so my understanding is that he had a formal military court-martial at which the charges were that he was disloyal, and he was acquitted at that.
For this activity in the 30s, not for anything in his military career.
That's my understanding, yeah.
So was this generated outside of the military then? I mean, I...
Well, what... Again, I don't know the details of you know, what he went through. This is one part of his past that I learned from my mother rather than from him. Although I've talked to him a lot about subsequent events, I haven't talked with him about this. I can't remember what the question was.
Just
what I was talking
if there
about.
Was any knowledge on your part as to where this court martial, you know, it was obviously done by the military.
Sure.
It wasn't about military.
Well,
matters,
I understand there was a purge in the military of left wing people at that time, and certainly the group of military people who were observers of the Chinese Communist movement were purged, and that. Something I've read about in
I'm
histories.
I'm also familiar with what's happened, for instance, in a lot of areas in the New York area, especially, I mean, it was actually quite, I think, had to do with anti-Semitism as well as people's membership in certain kinds of organizations. Mm-hmm. But again, from the early 30s on up.
Yeah, I guess...
targeting military, you know,
yeah,
obviously sensitive...
So my understanding is that in the early 40s there was, in the late 40s there was a purge in the military that essentially preceded the McCarthy sort of witch hunt.
But that was generated from the same
civilians.
Group of people.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Yeah. And that's, again, I think a particular base near where I grew up, a military installation with a local history, and that's important, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's all based on McCarthy and certain mm-hmm. people and Congress and the mm-hmm. Senate kind of practicing, actually, in the military what they decided worked so well that they would then take it on to the civilian.
Yeah. Well, my father didn't get back to the United States very frequently. He got back in 1948 for the trial, and also... he brought with him pots that had been made by people in this town of Kurashiki, where he was the governor mm-hmm. there. And these potters were great potters of Japan. Hamada was among them. And he took some of their work to the Museum of Modern Art in New York and suggested that maybe MoMA would want to do a show. And he says they just laughed at him, that this was craft and not art. And, you know, subsequently these people are living national treasures, or became living national treasures in Japan. But MoMA rejected their work.
I think maybe they've changed their tune now about the crafts versus high art. So
I don't really know. But anyway, so he came back. I mean, he had to be sort of altruistic to take these pots to...
Especially when he was,
he was just a young guy. Mm-hmm. Let's see, he was born in 1916, so he must have been...
38. Oh, yeah.
So 1948 32. Would be 32, yeah. As a result of the court-martial, he realized that his military career was done, and actually resigned from the military when he got back to Japan, and fortunately didn't sign up for the reserves in the way that many other people did when they left the army. The reservists were called up in Korea, and many of them were killed, of course. So my father sort of dodged that simply because he felt that the court-martial had damaged his
abilities,
his standing. Yeah. So in a sense, it was a lucky thing, although very traumatic for him at the time.
If I can, not to spend too much time on your father, do you know what his... Again, upbringing, background, family situation was that, for instance, he would find himself way back in the 30s. Again, he was not only showing crafts to MoMA in the 40s, but the civil rights movement in the 30s was, you know, extremely young.
Yeah. No, I don't really know. You know, it's not like there aren't any stories in my family like Bill Clinton, who, you know, went to his grandfather's store, right, and blah, blah. It's nothing like that. He grew up in suburban D.C. Mm-hmm. His father was an auto mechanic, and his mother, who I never knew his father, but his mother, who I knew, wanted a girl. So that's where the name Francis comes from. Right. But I don't really know much about his family. He has a sister who I met, but it was a long time ago.
That you hang out on the family reunions, and they're was he close to them perhaps before the almost kind of forced separation and not coming back to the country?
Well, certainly his mother visited Japan. When he came back to the States in subsequent years, he often went to visit his sister, but I don't really know why his family's not that close.
Maybe they just didn't get along. A good reason not to be close. I'd ask the same question about, you know, your mom's side of the family, and as you said, you moved back when you were 10 to Bel Air. Again, her background and upbringing and where she was from.
Her parents were Russian Jews. Her father came from the Ukraine in the 1890s on a boat to New York City. Her father and mother eloped, essentially from the Lower East Side, went to...
Economic reasons, or...?
No, their parents didn't approve of the relationship.
Because?
Okay. Don't remember. And moved to Denver. My mother was born in Denver, then they moved to Los Angeles. Her father did many things. He wasn't sort of a traditionally respectable individual. But,
was he on the lam a lot? Is that what you're implying?
No. He just did crazy things, you know, raised rabbits during the 20s to sell the meat and the...
he wasn't somebody who was
fur and
right, brought home the paycheck every week and
right. Was, I don't really know, kind of you know if he had a regular job or what he did. He had a house in a community near Palm Springs near La Quinta, or called La Quinta when I lived when I moved there. So we used to go out to the desert to his little house. I don't know how he, you know, got the money to get that. And, he was a character.
Mm-hmm. So you had more simply because you moved back to, when you moved to, not back, see, I'm doing it now too. When you moved to the States, it was mainly, you know, your mother was divorced and you were with her. And so you kind of, I mean, she went back to her family, in a sense.
Exactly. So she grew up in Los Angeles, went to high school in L.A., graduated from UCLA in the late 30s, and she was pretty left-wing at the time. And she and a woman who, a friend who ended up becoming Herman Wouk's wife, went off to Washington, D.C. to sort of make their way in the world. And that's where she met my father. Yeah, my father by that time had moved back to Washington, D.C. and was working in OP&A under Galbraith. But
had he gone to college? I just
my father didn't finish college. No, never went to college.
Experience that job.
Yeah. So he had a couple of years at the University of Maryland, but he didn't graduate. My mother had graduated from UCLA.
And so they perhaps met at some sort of, you know, gathering, whether it was informal or formal. We won't talk about anything like card carrying.
Oh yeah, no.
Whatnot.
Oh no, no, no.
I don't more think, like a.
Well, I think my mother was more into carrying cards than my father, and so I don't imagine that they met at a formal gathering, but at a meeting. My father, you know, talks about social things they did at the time, going to New York and listening to jazz in Harlem, or listening to Billie Holiday later in the 50s.
Politics, right.
Yeah, so, I don't know how they met. My father at that time had been married a year and divorced.
Okay. You mentioned, I think, two half-brothers, you said? And
yeah, so this first marriage was something that you know, lasted a year. Yeah. And my oldest brother, Bill, was what? Born
his old is his oldest child.
Yeah, so okay. He's in his 50s, 54. Okay. So that would be 1939 he was born.
Okay. Did you grow up knowing him or did he visit?
Not at all. I met him when I moved to after I moved to Los Angeles. My father was pretty absent from his life, so he and my father didn't really get along. They didn't know each other. They didn't have much of a relationship. And by the same token, when I moved to Los Angeles, Bill was active about getting in touch with me, and he took me to the Sierras for the first time, took me to the mountains backpacking and things like that. So Bill was conscientious about including me in his family or being in the same family that I was in. But I don't think he and my father had spent much time together over the years.
And then your other half-brother is younger and from the third.
Is younger, okay. Yeah. So my father was married for the third time after my parents were divorced, and he and his present wife had a son in 1964. So he's 27, lives in New York City.
And
sells bonds.
Contact.
Oh,
sells
no.
What?
He sells bonds. I think all the brothers are pretty close at this point, regardless of right. who our mothers were.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really draw those lines. And my youngest brother is half Japanese. He really kept up his fluency in the language. Mm-hmm. And so his business is selling bonds to Japanese banks. Mm-hmm. So he has a sort of Japan niche in that industry.
I wanted to actually just check with you and nothing. I mean, you said, can you still speak Japanese? Can you still understand it? Or is it something that you just have...
I'm very rusty. Yeah. It's been, like I said, almost 30 years. I speak mostly with my stepmother. Mm-hmm. And as a result, my speech is pretty feminine because I hear her, and men and women speak differently in that culture. My vocabulary is also pretty spotty, and it was it's pretty juvenile because I left when I was a kid. So I'm not really comfortable speaking Japanese. I can get around. I can listen to people and know what they're saying often. I can go to movies and understand much of the dialogue without reading the subtitles. In fact, I can, it's fun because I can tell when the subtitles are missing a lot of the
real stuff.
The real stuff, yeah.
I just want to turn the tape off.
Mm-hmm.